Well, thanks very much, Siv, and it's a real pleasure to be involved here, and I can't echo how much we welcome everyone for coming here. Some of you have come from long distances, and just how important we think this whole area is. And I was reminded, as of yesterday, in fact, I've been on call for the weekend, and I'm thinking about the symposium, and we're standing around the bed of a patient in the intensive care unit, and it's an infant with a, you know, problem of brain swelling, and we're sitting there, and the pressure is 35, which is very high for an infant, and there's a drain in the head, which appears to be partly working, and we're saying, you know, this does not make any sense. And, you know, we're fiddling with the drain and so on. And finally, we took that very prominent neurosurgical principle, when in doubt, operate. So we took the patient back to the operating room. We put a drain in the other side, and the pressure came down, and it's been normal. So, you know, there's a clear situation of a situation which looks on imaging, looks like there's a functioning drain. The drain appears to be partially patent. The ventricle on that side was collapsed. And that whole scenario did not make any sense to us. So it's not as though the problems we're going to be talking about here over the next couple of days are esoteric or are long-term applications. We have pressing need immediately to try and get a much better understanding of how the brain works biomechanically. You know, what are the issues with CSF? I mean, all kinds of theories were being invoked to explain this in terms of cerebral vascular activity, that the pressure monitor wasn't working, that was an inaccurate thing. So we really have a desperate need to try and improve upon things. So the theme, I'm obviously not a mathematician. The theme I've taken is just from the neurosurgical perspective, just how important neuromechanics is. And I'm going to talk a little bit about where I think we've been, because I think by looking backwards we can see what progress we've made and also where things we still haven't solved. And finally, just talk a little bit about the future. In terms of what remains unknown, aside from everything, I think there are some really important problems that we just simply haven't solved. And as I said, where do we go from here? So from neurosurgeons, we see intracranial pressure issues every day. I mean, that's part of what we do. And we can see it, you know, just at the bedside in a patient like this that has an open soft spot on their head, we can feel the pressure. And it wasn't very long before we could actually measure it. And it's been measured for decades, if not centuries, by various techniques. And nowadays we can measure the pressure very accurately, but still have a lot of trouble knowing what its significance was. But because it was a simple thing to measure, and because we could do it fairly simply, it became kind of the focus of neurosurgery and also of the models that were developed to try and deal with various pressure problems within the brain. And that invoked what I learned from Siv, and I can't tell you how much I've learned from my mathematical colleagues in terms of dispelling preconceived notions and asking, you know, the thunderbolt question about, and for example, well, when you inject that fluid into the brain to measure the pressure, you know, where does it go? And I'm thinking, well, you know, I never thought about that. And just things like that. So, but the compartment models for decades were extremely important because the brain is a rigid box, and you can inject fluid into it and look at the pressure changes, and you know, conservation of mass as whatever goes in has to come out, and you can develop some models from that. And I got involved with this in the 90s, and I'm borrowing some slides from Siv here just to talk about these compartmental models, because we thought that there were a large variety of different ones and that some of them, you know, addressed various issues. And I think one important thing I learned from Siv and Pino Tenti was that they're all very much the same, and they rely on mathematics that was developed in the 18th century. And they've been used in a large variety of applications. I'm just showing some of the early ones here, but they're still with us. I think they serve an important role, but the problem, again, as I've learned, is that they don't tell us very much about what's happening over the whole brain. We're just looking at one little component, and so there's no there's no distributed pressure measurements. And this is another thing that we are very familiar with clinically, is that's the idea of compliance. So if you inject something into the brain, the pressure goes up. We see that, again, every day. And models were developed based on this. And one of the most commonly used is Tony Marmorow's pressure volume index. And a number of models were developed on that, including one myself. So I got involved in this and started trying to predict what would happen to a patient if they had a shunt in their head, which is a drainage tube that goes inside the brain and down into another cavity. What would happen when they stood up? Because in the 80s and early 90s, we were very focused on this idea of over-draining the brain and the problems that that was causing. And so in order to better understand this, if only we could model that, that would really help us to understand what's going on, but also to design devices that could address this problem and improve the outcome of these patients. And so this was a model that I put together, and I'm modeling here three different kinds of shunts that behave quite differently. One's basically a standard piece of tubing with a one-way valve on it. One has a flow restricting component, and the other has a device which reacts to atmospheric pressure. And this is what this model predicted. And this was we can measure these pressures in patients, and this was measurements in patients looking at what happened when various valves, their pressure when they stood up. And sure enough, these devices were performing in the patients exactly as we thought. And you know, we thought this was fantastic. But you know, if we just go back, I was guilty because of my limited mathematics of forcing the parameters to fit the model, first thing. And secondly, and again, my mathematical colleagues politely pointed this out to me, that we hadn't really learned anything here. We hadn't, our ability to predict things, which is what models are for, really wasn't that much enhanced. And then we put these models to the clinical test. And so, why is it so important that we collaborate together? Well, one thing we can do for our mathematical colleagues, you can test your theories on various pieces of data, but we can actually take these theories, devices that are designed based on these theories, and we can take them and test them and see if that really performs as we expect, because that's ultimately what we're trying to do here, is try to improve what happens to patients. And I think this may be one of the few models that I've ever been involved in that actually was somewhat predictive, and I believe its results. And this is the simplest one that I've ever done. This is done by one of my residents, and we looked at how many holes do you need in a ventricular catheter? That's that catheter that goes into the brain. How many holes do you need in order to allow CSF to flow? And the answer is one. And except that then Dr. Tanti said, the flow around these orifices and shunts is not as simple as you think, which made me a little leery. But I think that theory was proved right yesterday, because it was just the last hole in this catheter that was blocked, and that was the problem. So I'm not going to say too much about pulsation. You're going to hear more of that later. But that was sort of another concept that came along as might being a very important. Again, that's something that we observe on a daily basis. And I'm going to show in the end some of the conundrums related to pulsation that we don't understand. But again, fairly old concept, turn of the century, of the previous century. And again, not a dramatic change in concept in terms of how it what it works. It's just simply changing the input function in terms of what goes into this black box. And neurosurgeons are always impressed when someone can put up something and say, there's an electrical analog for this, and you can simulate this easily on a computer. But again, as I've learned, this doesn't really add much meaning for us. So, I'm borrowing from my colleagues here, but one of the problems with compartmental models is treating the brain basically like a balloon. Many of us are guilty of fitting parameters to get the anticipated results. There's little insight to the pathologic process, and there's no spatial information. So based on this concept of a pressure, a rigid compartment, and CSF flow in and out, there have been a number of valves designed to drain fluid from the head into the abdomen. And and I'm just showing a history. These valves were developed in the 50s, and since then there have been 50 or 60 different signs trying to improve what happens. As I'll show you, the results with these shunts are very poor. And so it was thought that, you know, the valve is the problem, and if we just had a better model, we could improve things. And millions of dollars have been spent on developing these valves in order to improve the patient's outcome, with the idea that the more sophisticated valves are more physiological. That was sort of the concept. And this is Alfred Ashoff, who tested 750 different valves. He's talking about different variations of different ones. And he's taking a swing at me. I just put that up here because I wrote the shunt book, and he said, even these studies are unknown to me. So he, and if you test shunt tubing on a bench and just drop the tip down, you drop the pressure as you would expect. And that's what a standard differential valve looks like. This was something that came out in the 70s called an anti-siphon device, still being used fairly widely today. And the idea was that you can stop this dramatic change in pressure when the patient stands up if you allow this membrane that you can see there, if you allow this membrane to come in under atmospheric pressure and close it, and that's more physiological. And so these have been, were widely used then and widely used now. And if you test them on the bench, they perform like you would think. And if you question this idea of atmospheric pressure being applied correctly, then you can pressurize the outside of it, and sure enough, as you pressurize the outside of it, the pressure goes up, which we didn't need to do an experiment to prove this, but, you know, just being skeptical, we put this in a chamber and then we implanted it in animals, actually, and tested this notion that does it really see atmospheric pressure, and the answer is no, that the skin does not always transmit atmospheric pressure. And we found a couple of patients who were functionally blocked because the skin contracted on this diaphragm. An example of how a concept that seems very simple and performs on the bench as you expected, when it's tested in the patients, doesn't perform as usual. And that was the first kind of inkling we had that maybe our concepts were a little bit too simple. And then this is that flow restricting valve that I mentioned. It's very sophisticated. It has a machined ruby pin that's machined to a few thousandths of an inch tolerance. It has this very complicated flow pressure curve. It was tested in patients and said to be extremely effective. This is another one of those. This is a second version of the anti-siphon device. There have been hundreds of thousands of these implanted in patients. And as I said, one thing we can do is we can test these concept of models to see, you know, do they really work. And so these valves function very differently. They performed on the bench as expected, but we implanted them in patients, and this was 350 patients. They all perform the same. There's absolutely no difference in terms of how often the patients, and we were astonished at these results. We did not anticipate this at all. We thought that the better valve was going to be the winner. And that, I think, was, again, that was one of the first inklings that, you know what, this is way more complicated than we gave it credit. And no matter how long we followed these patients, it didn't make any difference. It looked like the valves, in fact, weren't all the same. And this one valve with the machine ruby pin, it looked like it just moved the obstruction downstream. I won't say too much about that, but it might have been doing something, but it just wasn't effective. And the real surprise was that when we looked at the size of the ventricles over the time period that we followed the patients, we would have expected that the valves that limited the flow would keep the ventricles up. I mean, that's what our model said. That's what, you know, just kind of common sense said. But you know what? Didn't make any difference. So in the patients, the ventricles came down at the same rate, despite the fact that these valves worked extremely differently. And then that's when we really started to say, okay, you know, are these models that we're using, they're not adequate. And it really came up with the sense that, you know, we shouldn't develop any more valves unless we have better information or at least a more robust model. And the other problem is it took a year for the ventricles to come down. So the models that we've been working with would simulate what went on for, 30 minutes, but we need models that are there for the long term. And so, yes, the models perform in vivo as they do on the bench on the short term, but doesn't appear to have an impact on clinical outcome. But it hasn't discouraged the companies or the engineers. This was a programmable valve. We can change the pressure to 18 different settings. Very sophisticated design. Thought, well, if we can't predict what the pressure needs to be to drain, we can just change it. But this was subjected to a clinical trial. Again, no difference. And then there's a history with valves that they're heralded as being an advance, and then there's problems. And so this valve, you could change the pressure on it by going too close to a television. And this is a programmable anti-siphon device, and was tested by a colleague of mine, and again, the results didn't look any better, despite the fact that it was changeable, and then this could be adjusted by a toy magnet. So there have been other flow valves, one of the issues with devices is they can come on the market if they just look like something else. They're not tested the same way drugs are. And this particular valve was developed in South America. It was tested on a bench. It was reported once by the designer who I think held the patent, and it's become fairly widespread. And there have been other valves coming along which are said to be better. They've been evaluated on the bench, but they haven't been subjected to prospective randomized trials, which is that study that I showed you was. And so there's a lot of suspicion amongst neurosurgeons that these valves really probably aren't any better or any different. And I won't belabor this too much, but this was a prospective randomized trial. Normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is in adults. You're going to hear more about that at this meeting. It's a very complicated problem that's poorly understood. But when a randomized trial was done, it didn't seem that the valves made much difference. And this caused a lot of excitement. This was a valve designed to treat Alzheimer's disease, and we all know how common Alzheimer's disease is. And the idea with this valve is it would just take a little bit of the CSF that had the toxins in it, and that would improve Alzheimer's disease. And there was an initial study suggesting that, yes, indeed, this might work, but the study was halted, and randomization was closed, and ultimately it was reported that it was of no benefit. So we have to ask ourselves, have we really made any progress? So I think it takes a while to realize just how little you understand about a problem, and I suppose that might be very much part of our progress. And this is what I call the valve design cycle. There's innovation based on improved physiological function, there's exciting early results, there's failure of efficacy on prospective evaluation, and there's unanticipated consequences. So is that the end of shunt technology? I don't think so. I think this is still a very fruitful area for research. I think we can do better. The designs we're using are extremely unsophisticated compared to what is available now in terms of various kinds of mechanics, including MEMS technology. There's issues around whether these things would be financially viable, but it may be that if we can't completely understand the problem from a mathematical point of view on a short time frame, maybe we can measure our way out of this and just measure everything and use large volumes of data about patients with valves implanted and come up with a way of designing what we think might be a better strategy. So that might be one way of doing this. So work, watching the group in Waterloo go develop these consolidation models seems to be a much more sophisticated process. I won't obviously say too much about them, and I wouldn't begin to understand the mathematics. But they've led to a number of models which have addressed the spatial issues and have made some significant early progress, but one of the limitations has been trying to develop a model that is robust over the long term. One thing that they were able to do was to look at the shape of the ventricles over time and develop a model to predict that, and that's something that we are quite interested in. This is, some of the data from Waterloo on ventricular shape as a function of time seem to be fairly robust prediction, and one of our problems is we think that we're perhaps putting the catheters in the wrong place, that there should be a place we could put them where it's unlikely to become obstructed. We've actually tested this a couple of times. The first time we were using these tiny little endoscopes to look inside the brain and place the catheter at what we thought was an ideal place. But as constant theme, there's no benefit from doing that in a prospective randomized trial. If we could keep the catheter away from the choroid plexus, then that suggests that we might be doing better. But this was, you know, after the fact. And we've just finished the study that's not been reported, using ultrasound to try and place the catheter more accurately. Again, prospective study, 80 patients, no benefit. So there's a lot that we don't understand, and this is just showing, this is the ultrasound picture, this is the CT scan on its side, this is an ultrasound picture, here's the catheter, so we can see the catheter, but we just can't seem to make a difference. So we started to go away from shunts, and I'm just showing here, we're making a small hole in the floor of the brain to try and bypass a blockage. So thinking, well, if we can't drain the fluid effectively outside the brain, then maybe we can just make a small opening inside the brain and bypass the block. And this operation really came along in the early 90s and now is done quite frequently. The advantage of it is that you don't have to implant any hardware. It's more physiological, which always makes me nervous to say that. And it's fairly simple. It has a higher risk because there's a very important blood vessel here that you can't injure, and this is a very important part of the brain. But this is one way of getting away from shunt hardware. But there are also some very important biomechanical and neuromechanical issues related to this operation, which are unsolved. And this isn't the same operation in an infant, which I won't show, but the failure rate is not that much better than shunts. So why is that? Well, some of it's age. And you're going to be hearing in this workshop about age effects on the brain and so on, and this just shows how important they are. So very clear, so the younger patients, this is a patient, this is the percentage of patients that are failing or proportion that are failing, and the young patients are failing at a dramatic rate. So same operation. So, you know, why is that? And this has been duplicated in a number of different studies, so this is real. Shunts, the same thing. The younger patients are doing worse. So there are some very important age effects that we don't totally understand. So I'm just going to start to wrap things up by just talking about some of the mysteries. I talked about one of them that started off that we see. And this is something called the slipped ventricle syndrome. And so this is these are patients who have small ventricles and high pressures. And this is a patient who has a long, complicated history, but small ventricles, but when the pressure is measured, it's very high. We put this flow-restricting valve in, ventricles go up in size, and the pressure goes down. So conceptually, that's hard for us to understand, and the symptoms get better. Everything's patent. So we don't have an explanation for that. We don't see it commonly, but it's not rare. There's another patient, same thing. This patient, 10-year-old girl, small ventricles, same operation, everything's patent, ventricles go up in size, pressure goes down, symptoms get better. This is a baby who's probably been injured by a caregiver and likely shaken. So we never actually know what the mechanism was, but this patient has a very dark brain, which looks ischemic. So this whole hemisphere and part of this hemisphere looks like the blood supply has been cut off, and there's a very small rim of blood here that's non-significant. And we don't see this in any other age group. So we just see this in children. There's no sign of trauma. The blood vessels are all patent, and we have no idea why this happens. So again, there's obviously, this is a biomechanical event, but we don't really understand what the mechanism is, and it has horrific consequences. This is this patient's in delayed fashion, and you know, large parts of the brain have been permanently damaged. This is another example. This is a patient with syringomyelia. Now, that's a long name for fluid building up inside the spinal cord, and one of the theories of the problem is that there's a block here between the head and the spine, and the back part of the brain herniates down, and for whatever reason, fluid builds up inside the spinal cord. And we know that if we open this up, make this bigger, usually the problem goes away. So I don't think we know why the fluid builds up in the spinal cord down here, when there's a block up here. And there are various theories about this, which I won't go into, but I don't think any of them adequately explain this phenomenon. And sometimes it just doesn't work. So this is after the operation. You can see we've made things bigger, but the fluid, if anything, is worse, and the ventricles have gone up. And then just following this patient, things have just continued to get worse. So again, the problems we're talking about are with us on a daily basis, and I have no explanation for this. So if you had asked me where have we made the most progress, in terms of applications of mathematics to neurosurgery, well, I think one of the big ones would be imaging. And this is a patient who has epilepsy and has a very small abnormality on the brain that was there from development that we can only see on a very high Tesla MRI. And these are the motor tracts. So this is right beside the motor tracts. So the patient has an operation, you have to be very careful. And now we know where the motor tracts are. So that's something that we didn't know 10 years ago. And we can now integrate imaging and function. So these are magnetoencephalography spikes. So this patient has squids placed over the head, and we can measure the induced fields and localize these spikes to this abnormal area. And then we can use positron emission tomography to look at changes in blood flow and metabolism related to this abnormality. So I think we've made a lot of progress that way. And we can also, again, integrate language into this mapping. So I think we've made lots of progress in that area. If you were to ask me, aside from hydrocephalus, which is obviously my primary interest, what are the other areas within neurosurgery are going to be fruitful? Well, I think that simulation is going to become very big in our specialty within the decade. It's already in the other surgical specialties, because just like airline pilots need to practice on a simulator, so do surgeons, and simulation is becoming increasingly common. And some of the specialties it's fairly not that complicated to develop a simulation model. I'm thinking of laparoscopy, where you have these tools that go inside an abdomen, and it's very easy to develop something like that. The brain's a bit more complicated, but there is work going on in this area, and I'm going to borrow from Robert Dorado's group at NRC, developing VR systems for surgical oncology. And I think someone from his group is here today, is that right? Yeah, great. Yeah. So I want to provide full acknowledgement to your group for these slides, but I just wanted to show this because I think it's very exciting work. And they are using neuromechanics to try and increase make these models as robust as they can, and particularly looking at the changes in tissue properties of tumors, and one of them involves brain tumors. And so I'm just going to finish by showing a video of the simulator that's over at the Toronto Western, which I've tried, and it's has binocular vision. It has two probes that are passive robotic devices, but ultimately haptics will be involved in this. And this is, I'm going to show you just what kind of progress they've made developing this thing. And I think this is going to be coming, I think, very important for training, but also at the moment it's very hard to evaluate surgeons in terms of how good they are, and it's going to become really important, and I'm very sensitive to this, as surgeons get older, how well they're going to be able to perform. It's very difficult to test things. So I'm told that Air Canada pilots can no longer fly the simulator effectively after the age of 62. So right now there are lots of surgeons older than 62 that are operating on patients. So just here's the and you can see that the brain is pulsating, the vessels are disappearing as this is a cautery device and this is a sucker, and then the sucker is going to be introduced and try and remove the tissue, and as I said, ultimately the tissue will feel differently than the brain itself, and there's bleeding, so there's active bleeding which obscures the field, and you're scored on how you do this. And so I said that I was on the simulator for a while and my scores did start to improve with time. So this sort of thing is going to be extremely important. So I guess I'm showing this just to show what the range is out there in terms of the applications of neuromechanics to the nervous system, in particular neurosurgery. So I think it's an extremely exciting field. I think this is a great time for people to become involved. And I know that these workshops often result in a lot of interesting developments and collaborations, and I'm really looking forward to this one. So thank you very much. So we can do that on the short term very easily. So, you know, over 30 minutes while we're in the operating room, yes, we can, you know, look at the ventricles and look at the size of the ventricles and we can watch them collapse. But that's not, the issue is more the long-term phenomenon, and that's where it's much more difficult to measure the pressure. So there's a lot of interest in implantable pressure transducers. There's been problems to date because it's hard to get a transducer that is small and doesn't drift over time. There are some available, they're kind of crude, they're sort of diaphragms that you push on the head, but there are monitors coming along, and Adam, maybe we'll hear about them during this workshop. So I think knowing the pressure over the long term would be very valuable. We all think that. But right now we don't have an easy way of measuring the pressure over the long term. There's no haptics yet, but they're going to, my understanding is you're going to introduce haptics, is that right? Yeah. So. I don't think so. What do you think? I think the concept of developing something that you can control fairly accurately, if we can't, completely understand the problem, then maybe we can kind of measure our way out of it. And that, in some sense, I think, does that, because that pump should also be able to measure pressure, is what I'm understanding, ultimately. So, I don't know. I mean, my concern is it's another... I like the idea that it's doing something that's accurate and measurable and changeable. My concern is that it's also more physiological, and we've been down that road so many times before that without measuring pressure and flow at the same time, I don't think it would be a great advance. So it's based on the symptoms coming back.
Okay.
But we.
Do you know of any study that actually assesses?
Yes, there's some interesting information coming out suggesting that the cognitive development in these kids is no better. And the other thing I didn't mention is that the ventricles don't come down when you do this operation. That is, they stay up. So that was discounted for a while as not being important, but some of the cognitive information is coming out suggesting that. They're not better off, actually, even patients who've had shunt problems. And the final thing is that the patients don't see their quality of life as being much better.